Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Jahan Satour. Jahan is a CTAA accredited self-sabotage coach who uses tools such as cognitive behavioral therapy and hypnosis to help get to the root causes of self-sabotaging beliefs and behaviors and remove them permanently so that you can live a fully empowered, peaceful, and purposeful life. And with that, Jahan, it's a pleasure having you on the show today.
Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. And we had a very interesting pre-chat. I think we initially met through one of the podcast guest forums that podcasters and podcast guests typically utilize. And we had a really interesting pre-chat. Found out that you were a musician by trade. And we were talking about guitarists who didn't really get their due. And we ended up talking about Lindsey Buckingham of Fleetwood Mac. I think we both agreed that he was an underrated guitarist and producer who never got his due. And then from there, we started talking about planning the podcast episode. So I'll let you add to that if you want to add a little bit more to the Buckingham mystique. If not, we can just move on to our first podcast question.
Yeah, he doesn't get it. And I think I've only seen his name on a couple lists recently, but it still wasn't ranked where it should be. And everybody still wants to give all the old guys like Jimi Hendrix all the credit. And we know how that goes. Mm-hmm. That's just, I guess, a tribal type thing. You know, you're the cult of Jimi Hendrix, so you got to put that at the top.
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix, Jimmy Page, you know, all of those guys. But Buckingham, he had talent that, and still does, that is unique in and of itself.
Yeah.
Well, with that, now that we've kind of solved the guitarist dilemma problems of the world, I guess we might as well move on to what we're really here to talk about, which is your work with self-sabotage and how that plays out in the individuals that you work with. But first and foremost, I'd like to ask you to tell our listeners about the experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions.
Yeah. So, I mean, my life started out, I guess, in a pretty rough way. My father was an alcoholic, and my sister is what they now call a narcissist. And back then, we didn't have any names for it. You know, you're talking about 1987. We didn't really talk about this kind of stuff the way it is now. And we could never really figure out what the heck is wrong with these people. Like, why are they so aggressive and mean, and why they always gaslight us and all these different things? And why was he so verbally abusive, especially to me? Because as a kid, when you're a little kid, you just look up to your parents no matter what they do. And I just wanted to help him all the time. And I knew that I was happy and all kinds of things like that. I would sit with him sometimes and talk. He would just say mean things. And when I got older, a teenager, he continued on with the same thing. He pretty much just didn't like anything that I did. He saw any success that I had in anything as an injury to him. And I could never figure out why that was until later, of course. And it affected me. And for anybody that lives in the Caribbean, they know exactly what I'm talking about when I say that the culture and how they treat children is very rough anyway. You get beat for pretty much everything. If you have a normal child's reaction to something and you cry, you get beat for that. And they say, oh, you want something to cry for? No, beat you for that. You weren't allowed to express any opinions on anything. Children were to be seen and not heard. and it damaged me. And I see in society, living back here after years of being abroad, I see how different it is from American culture and even other places in the world. I see how gentle it is in other places, but here it's hardcore. And I see how damaged other people are in society. So that pretty much just sent me on a path of being addicted, because I got exposed to alcohol and drugs anyway from a very young age, just doing music. And that seems to be a thing that all musicians seem to unconsciously agree on, this idea of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So I got caught up in that, and it ruined my perspective of myself even further. It just ruined a lot of things for me. And I got to a point where I couldn't, even though I was succeeding at music, I couldn't keep money in my pocket. I couldn't keep relationships. I felt as though just because I was different, I was being unfairly attacked by all the people around me, all kinds of different issues. And I tried to commit suicide on 3 different occasions. And I actually had what people call a near-death experience. And back then I had no clue that was a thing, but I just knew that it was something special and unique that happened for a reason. And I remember when I came back from that, I had felt like I'd been transmitted to, like I had this kind of thought transfer from whatever beings were there, because there were 2 beings, one on the left and one on the right. And it was just a very peaceful experience. It wasn't like what other people say, like they heard the voice of God, or they saw the destruction of humanity, or they saw loved ones or anything like that. I just went to this place, nothing was happening. These 2 beings were trying to communicate something to me, but I know that when I came back, my entire attitude was different. How I felt about myself, how I felt about the world, all that changed radically. My personality changed. I didn't want to be the same person, stuck in the same place, doing the same things for my whole life. And I remember sleeping for about 2 weeks straight. And then after that, I got up and I got after it, and I started doing a lot of inner work and getting into meditation and reading about psychology and wanting to study psychology and all kinds of stuff like that. So I'll let you take it from there.
Near-death experiences have been documented since, I think, the late 1800s. There are features that are probably unique to each near-death experiences, but there are similarities. Like for you, you came back with a sense of understanding of how the universe really actually works.
Yeah.
A desire to re-engage in life, a spiritual being associated with the religion that you've been affiliated with, or just a deceased loved one, or just highly evolved spiritual beings in general, are typically what individuals encounter.
Yeah, definitely. I have no idea who those beings were. I just knew that I felt like I had a mission. I felt like I had a purpose. Okay. And before that, I was just drifting aimlessly. And all I wanted to do was play guitar for a living. I didn't know anything else other than I wanted to do that. And I knew that when I did it, people seemed to be happy. And that was the only sense of fulfillment that I had to hang on to until that point. But that was enough to keep me going. I always wanted more. And besides that near-death experience, when I was 7, I almost died from a really bad asthma attack. And I remember having an out-of-body experience where I just drifted upwards and I saw myself and I saw my family and I saw my sister sitting on the bed and everybody was like crying and things like that. And that changed me too, but I wasn't aware that experience had changed me because I was only 7 years old, you know? Uh-huh. But I think that it also primed my system for what was to come later, because even as I was moving through life during that stage, I never felt like I was like everybody else. Not that I thought I was more special or anything, but I thought that I saw through society. And I think that having that as an underlying feeling, just not trusting society, that'll send you crazy. Yeah. If you don't know how to process it.
Yeah, it will. And one of the other things that struck me about your experience was that the reason you come back to Earth is that it's not your time to die yet. and you're told, we're going to put you back into your body and you're going to fulfill your life's mission. So, you know, that's the other part of that. But you're right. I think the other piece with trust is, yeah, it's difficult if you can't trust what society is either is throwing out at you. We have to be able to at least trust individuals to an extent, because really, as human beings, we're not meant to exist on an island by ourselves. We need to have some type of social stimulation and stimulation from others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that where the self-sabotage thing really came into play was my curiosity for what is change? Because I started asking myself that question. I looked around and I saw all these people who were gurus or like Tony Robbins type people, yeah, coaches, etc. And I asked myself, what is change? Because it doesn't appear as though these people have individuated very much. Even though they have all this so-called wisdom, they're still saying everything that sounds like a narrative to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that because I attribute it, that type of thinking, to just having that early distrust for society and realizing that something out there ain't right. And it seemed like everything was fueling this narrative or this series of narratives that push you right back into what they call the matrix, so to speak. Whereas if you walk a different path, you have to become an individual. You have to become separate from society to figure out who you are completely, and then try to reintegrate and be a part of humanity and be around other people and things like that. But I think I wanted to be an individual. I didn't want to be a part of the herd. I never have wanted to be a part of the herd. I've always been the kind of person to keep to myself. Never had a lot of friends or anything like that, because I realized that having a lot of friends eventually led to trouble, so to speak. Or you just have to put up with stuff that you don't necessarily want to deal with. And it just wasn't for me. I think asking myself that question was one of the major things that got me looking at how am I really doing stuff that doesn't belong to me? What actions and emotions don't belong to me? And I got hooked on that because that was very fascinating.
Yeah. And I think when we start taking ownership of emotions or feelings that aren't ours, it drains our energy. And I think we have to be able to dictate what's ours and what's somebody else's. What can we take ownership of and what can we let go? Or what can we realize is just part of our external surroundings that we can choose not to really buy into? So, and that's an interesting perspective, I think, to have in terms of what's mine, what isn't, and how do I know the difference?
Yeah.
You talked about self-sabotage. I know that's something that's a major part of the work that you do with individuals who request services from you. Define for our listeners what self-sabotage is and what some of the factors that you see that contribute to self-sabotage behavior in individuals.
Okay, so let's run the slides then.
Yeah. As a teacher, as a teacher, this is close to my heart because I love PowerPoints. So you have a very captive audience with me. So go ahead and take it away.
Right. Yeah, so this is my definition of self-sabotage, and it's thoughts, beliefs, emotions, behaviors, or actions which inhibit your progress in any area of life, including success, health, wealth, joy, abundance, and spiritual growth. Now, I have here that self-sabotage is a byproduct of subconscious programming and conditioning. Now, why do I make a distinction? Because especially on social media, you hear a lot about programming. If you know about psychology, you know about B.F. Skinner and those guys, then you know that conditioning is basically things that are done repetitively or within your environment, some kind of action, or you habitually do something. Because I don't want to make it seem like everybody's a victim all the time. Like, we make decisions and we do things and we condition ourselves, right? But for me, programming is a set of linguistic statements. So that's where all of the beliefs are separated from the actions and things that society tells us and that we do and all that. So it's those things manifest as patterns of thinking and behaving which live below our conscious awareness. And I have here self-sabotage results in procrastination, people-pleasing, self-doubt, fear of failure, fear of success, negative self-talk, addiction, perfectionism, avoidance of emotional self-regulation, financial instability, avoidance of self, avoidance of intellectual maturity, spiritual bankruptcy, poor relationships, victimhood, or poor health. A lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's really what's going on out there. All right. I would have to say that's a good set of discussion that we have.
And touch for on. Me, yeah, that is. And that just, the effects of self-sabotage just run the gamut. You can look at practical considerations like just finances or bankruptcy, right from the spiritual and also to the fear of failure. One of my primary tasks or jobs I did for 27 years was I was an addictions counselor, and I was a clinical supervisor for a state-run agency in the state of New York. And one of the things that I noticed quite a bit with clients was that they would relapse because they would engage in self-sabotage behavior because they didn't believe that they were worthy of the success that came with recovery, or they were just so bored in recovery that they needed to do something to develop excitement again. Mm-hmm. And essentially that would result in a spiral of them for guilt and shame that we would have to deal with when they came back into treatment. But I agree with you that it is subconscious, because I think like anything, like you look at defense mechanisms are unconscious ways that individuals prevent themselves from looking at the reality of their situation. And it's done very subconsciously. It's also done very unconsciously. And until they're willing to be made aware of those patterns of behavior, it's going to go on unchecked. Mm-hmm. And it was intriguing to me that you looked at self-sabotage as being a subconscious set of behaviors that we engage in. But I think you're right. I think B.F. Skinner talked about consequences of behavior and Edward Thorndike with the law of effect, that a behavior that has positive consequences tends to get reinforced, and a behavior that has negative consequences tends to not get reinforced. But any mm-hmm. type of behavior, even a negative behavior or self-sabotage behavior that gets reinforced either through attention or through just individuals just simply ignoring the impact, that behavior is going to become more and more ingrained and is going to become more, I think, subconsciously manifested.
Yep, that's exactly it. And I like to operate on a presupposition that most people actually know what they're doing. They just ignore that they're doing it, or ignore that they're feeling it, or whatever the case is, because there's emotional self-sabotage too, right?
Yep.
And what caught my attention with myself, because I am leading people through a process based on what I discovered by experimenting on myself first and foremost. I would never sit here and tell anybody about anything that I don't know about on a personal level. That, to me, that's ridiculous, right? So what I found is that it's more physically and emotionally and even spiritually taxing for people to maintain and operate from self-sabotaging beliefs than it actually is for them to change and free themselves from it. And it's like you were saying about the addictive behavior. I find that self-sabotage and addictive thinking patterns, as you would see in, I think it's Aaron Beck has a book on cognitive therapy for substance abuse, and the beliefs in that, especially the craving beliefs and the things like that, are the same as the self-justifications that people use to maintain their self-sabotage. But just to give a little bit of context for people on the subconscious part, because there's still a surprising number of people that don't know this, only 1% to 5% of your daily actions are coming from conscious awareness, and everything else is subconscious, right? So that means that if you have a lot of negative programming or conditioning, then for the majority of your day, you're actually doing stuff that sabotages you. And I would not sit here from a position of being perfect either, because nobody is. Sometimes I do things or I think things But because I know what to look for, I'm catching it before I get myself into trouble, right?
Uh-huh.
And what people don't understand is that programming or conditioned behaviors are triggered by any stress on your limbic system. So that could be something, a life event that's happening now. It could be something in the external world that is putting you into survival mode. It could be childhood stuff. It could be from a past life. It could be because of exposure to environmental toxins. When I say environmental toxins, I mean, maybe it's mold or something like that. Or maybe it's some kind of other pesticide or something somebody spraying somewhere. It could be chemicals in food. It could be too much sugar. It could be caffeine. And I single those things out because we tend to walk this path where allopathic medicine has put blinders on everybody. And so we no longer recognize, especially in the Western world, that our organs are intelligent and they talk to us and they tell us, hey, knock it off. Don't eat cookies every day. Or, hey, maybe 2 cups of coffee was too much for this, you know, just this morning. And a lot of people are suffering as a result of that, but it goes ignored. And then they put all of these hit pieces out into the public domain that suggest that drinking coffee or you can do everything in moderation. And the everything in moderation is another conditioned belief, because wherever there's moderation, you find mediocrity and you find self-sabotage, because people will say, okay, yeah, it doesn't matter. I'll just have a cigarette now and I can stop tomorrow, or I'll just go out and have a couple of beers and everything will be okay. And I won't be drinking throughout the week. But that's putting a huge tax on your organs, right? And I single out aggressive music and songs with heavy emotional content, because those things, you know, the aggressive music, it affects your brain negatively and it affects you on a cellular level. It's vibrating your cells in a way that it's hard for them to recover. Sound frequency, they use sound to destroy things in the past. They even tell you that in like the Bible and stuff, when they're talking about the walls of Jericho and stuff, look at what they did. They destroyed it using sound, right?
Mm-hmm.
So things with heavy emotional content in it, like your favorite songs and stuff, if you're continuously rehashing a situation, you're going to have all these chemicals, as like Candace Pert described in her book, Molecules of Emotion. You're going to have all these chemicals that are triggered by your emotions, and it's causing you to rewire the same neurons, the same clusters of neurons over and over with the same patterns of thinking and the same patterns of behaving. Because when you have an emotional response that's negative, you're going to try to comfort yourself with something else, right? So it's either going to be more music or it's going to be food or alcohol or something. So if you don't know how to deal with your unique triggers and stressors, then you're pretty much screwed. And I think that is something that, especially in the age of social media and stuff, we tend to just ignore everything and use screens as a coping mechanism. Video games, movies, people go on Netflix binges and things like that. And screens are very detrimental to your brain function as well. And they're only just talking about this, but people have known for years, because your generation would have grown up hearing this, and my generation definitely heard up growing this, that, you know, too much TV is going to rot your brain. And they weren't joking. So back to the subconscious, it's all about things that keep you safe, even though it will run programs that seem safe to it, but it's going to destroy any sense of security that you have through destructive actions. And it loves things that are familiar, even when that comfortable place is a comfortable pain, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's why we individuals have so much difficulty entertaining change, because even though what was comfortable for them are things that they've, or survival mechanisms that they've had developed during chaos, it's still something that is familiar to them. And to have to let go of that, to embrace something different, is like it's embracing the unknown. So they're very, it may be very difficult to get them to engage in a situation where they're looking they're looking to teach them how to deal with their triggers differently. And that can be a very daunting task. But once they cross that threshold and they embrace change and they see the positive consequences, they'll look at me and say, what the heck was I waiting for? Why was I so worried about it? But it's very difficult to get to relinquish something that's familiar, even though it's chaotic, because the familiarity outweighs the chances for happiness. So individuals, I think, will tend to stay in that self-sabotage cycle for that reason.
I like to use the saying that you don't see the picture when you're inside the frame to describe how the subconscious mind works. So, and that's us, every human being on this planet, every day, all day long. We are looking at something, but we are not seeing the bigger picture. We're not seeing our role in it. We think that we're fine when we say and do and feel the things that we say, do, and feel, but we don't know what we don't know at all. And that continues as just a fact of life until the day that we die. We just don't know what we don't know. I think that we are seeing a time in humanity where people are more interested, though. They're noticing that things are going on, and they're beginning to understand again that we actually have more control over what we put in our mind and our body. But there's so much misinformation out there, especially in the media, and I have no idea why people don't see that, especially people that have kids. Because you know this, you have kids and grandkids. So when a little kid is trying to hide something from you and they're trying to lie about something, they get very frantic and they act really funny, and they start making up things over here. Say, oh no, don't worry about that. Look over here. This thing that I did that was good. And we see that kind of behavior in the public domain. And we need to stop looking outside of ourselves and have a little bit more trust in our internal wisdom to know that if something feels wrong, then we should probably not be doing that. Or we should probably look for our own source of information, our own source of evidence on that thing, because there's so much that goes on out there. But everything that we need to know, there's a saying, nothing new under the sun. Everything that we need to know has already been known for so many thousands of years. It's not going to change, right? In that way, we all just become products of what we've been conditioned to learn. And with all of the stuff that's going on in our environment these days, everything is always on. We always have these death rectangles on us, as I like to call them, because when you're on these and you're doom scrolling or you're just taking in content and stuff, except for Teaching Journeys podcasts, of course, don't get me wrong on that one. But when you're looking for external input, your soul is dying. You're not paying attention to your real deep internal needs. And what the technology is doing is that it's overstimulating our brain pathways. The caffeine, the sugar, all the chemicals overstimulate the limbic system. So we become hostages then of these negative subconscious processes. And where is that coming from? Again, through repetitive content, repetitive ideas, repetitive stuff in the media that they keep saying over and over. Politicians that tell the same lies over and over. Mm-hmm. How pop psychology hijacks a lot of complex theories and simplifies them and leads people in the wrong direction, where they think something's broken and they'll never ever get better from those things. All that stuff is done on purpose, and we get conditioned to accept destructive habits and activities as fun and normal. In fact, humor is one of the number one tools that has been used throughout time, from back when there was just the town square and you had the Joker in the kingdom or whatever, to get people to turn a blind eye to things that are serious. Anything that is really bad for us and that is going to systematically weaken us and steal your health and energy and vitality and your capacity to think is going to be packaged as something funny, something that's casual. It's going to be really great. It's going to be this for the greater good, all stuff. All of the scientific research studies out there that validate a lot of this stuff is bought and paid for. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stuff has taken us so far away from traditional wisdom. One of the best things I've heard was from another hypnotist, Drake Eastburn. He wrote a really good book called what is hypnosis really? And he talks about how perceived authority is also a state of trance. Being in a state of expectation is a state of trance. Not knowing what to do in a particular situation puts you in a state of trance. So it, then essentially the question that he's posing to people is, what is not hypnosis? Rather than separating ourselves from just being in a normal state and then being under hypnosis, when are we not in hypnosis is the big question he's asking. So it's easy for us to have any little thing happen and then we go into our subconscious mind. And we might be thinking that we've come back into conscious awareness, but for some time period, we're actually still in a state where we're running more negative coping strategies for things, right?
Yep, absolutely. And then those negatives end up becoming really for individuals who engage in those. You add two negatives together, you get a positive. So if they keep engaging in negative behavior, for them, it's a positive. And then when you try to introduce them to things that are truly positive, it really causes, I think, some type of dissonance because they've been used to negative being positive for so long because they haven't engaged in that. And the other thing that you mentioned, this reminds me of something that I heard said. If you tell the same lie over and over again, people begin to believe it's the truth. And the other thing I think that tends to happen is that, and I've talked about this with other guest contributors, Johan, is that we are a society that doesn't, many of us don't engage in critical thinking. We don't really take a look and say, what is the legitimacy of the source that this information is being quoted from? Or a lot of it, and a lot of individuals also, in addition to that, don't trust that the answers that they have to any situation lie within them. Sometimes they will rely too much, I think, on external, like you said, gurus and other individuals to tell them what's real and what isn't real. And for me, it's like we can determine that for ourselves. We can take a look at external input as just input, but it's up to us to decide what is real, what isn't real, and how do we determine the difference?
Yeah, and for me personally, a big part of my healing was just realizing how much of myself and my critical thinking faculties I had suppressed by worrying about what everybody else was saying. Yeah. And I developed this thing where no matter what anybody else says, I have to be able to think for myself. And I have to be able to find a comfortable set of ideas, because I think it's actually safer to not believe in anything so strictly than it is to actually grasp onto something tightly, because you block any further learning once you accept something as being a truth, right? I have my slides back up just so that people can read along and get the gist of what was said. But what I like to talk about is how the brain pathways get overloaded. And so I'll move on to why is that actually a problem? And how does that relate to self-sabotage? It says right here, the limbic system has three pathways that send and receive information, and it's put into some kind of emotion, and that's usually negative. And the way that your pathways are interacting together will dictate your perceptions and emotions, as well as the resulting behavioral responses. So I like to talk about three pathways, and I'll show them on the screen first before I talk about them. And that's the reward pathway. And I often say that behind every behavior is a reward, but it shows you here the prefrontal cortex, where that's located. It shows you the nucleus accumbens, where that's located. And it shows you how it's connected to the ventral tegmental area. The next pathway, it's basically the same pathway, except it's showing you how it connects. Everything goes through the prefrontal cortex. That's the most important part to understand. And it's showing how it sends information to the dorsal raphe nucleus, which has a lot to do with serotonin. And then the stress fear memory pathway, it's showing you how the prefrontal cortex is the beginning of that pathway. And it goes to the amygdala, which then goes to the hippocampus and the hypothalamus. So the interesting thing about those pathways is that all of those, like I said, are basically being targeted in a way, like whether it's coming from the media or the chemicals that scientists sit in the labs making, or when they recalibrate old ones, because sugar isn't made the same way that it used to be. They add lime and all kinds of other acids to it to cut it, to make that sugar yield actually stretch a lot more. And that impacts your brain in a worse way. But when you talk about the reward pathway, what's happening there is that it's using dopamine to communicate to the ventral tegmental area. And there's dopamine receptors that are in the nucleus accumbens. And those are responsible for giving you feelings of motivation and give you that sense of reward. And you get those same feelings when you learn something. Like, that's the same pathway that is being engaged right now when people are listening to this podcast. So through that same pathway, you learn what feels good for you. So you're learning that sugar is good, alcohol feels good, caffeine feels good, porn feels good, shopping, you name it. Anybody that's seen My Strange Addiction, that TV show on, I think it's TLC or something like that. Mm-hmm. People feel good when they use a wire coat hanger to dig hair out of a shower drain. Like, whatever it is, that's that pathway, right? And it's because of endogenous opioid peptides that are released by these different clusters of neurons that you have that are wired in there by having some effect at like a reward, which is just the production of something that feels like heroin or morphine to you, is the feeling of pleasure or bliss, right? So that's in self-sabotage. That's what we're chasing when we're doing something that we don't necessarily like, but we do it anyway, and it causes problems in our lives, but we do it anyway. That's why it's not only drugs, but anything can be an addiction. It doesn't have to even make sense. Yeah. But the next pathway that I talk about is the contentment pathway, and that's where that very small amount of serotonin that's produced in the brain is communicating between the dorsal raphe nucleus, and that's an area in the midbrain that contains more neurons that manufacture that serotonin, just to be clear on that. So that little percentage of serotonin is moving to different areas of the cerebral cortex, and it gives you the ability to process experiences and determine what's good and what's bad for you. So that's why we say that good and bad is subjective, right? It really isn't, but to the brain, it's a chemical thing. So basically how that serotonin is acting in the different parts of your brain is going to give you a different cognitive outcome, which is solely dependent on what clusters of neurons you uniquely have built throughout your life. My favorite pathway to talk about is the stress, fear, memory pathway, because that has a lot to do with how we pick up information subconsciously through watching television and things like that. That stress, fear, memory pathway is made of the amygdala, which is the stress, fear center. And that's talking to the hypothalamus, which is controlling your hormones, including cortisol. And then the hypothalamus is talking to your sympathetic nervous system and telling it, okay, you need to go into fight or flight. And so that then tells your vagus nerve to stop working because you have to prepare for an emergency. And that part is relevant because the vagus nerve is that really long nerve that runs all the way up through your spine, up to the back of your head. And how you breathe determines your stress level. And I think that should be obvious for a lot of people that mm-hmm. when they notice that something happens, they might start to take a deep breath, or their nostrils will flare or things like that. And so then you also have the hippocampus, which is the memory center, and it interprets memories as either good or bad, but it basically stores all the pain from childhood, all of the emotional content of the last movie you watched, the last song you listened to. It's storing all the stuff that you look at on social media. All the visual content is basically being recorded and stored there. It's like the tape in the tape recorder. in this stress fear memory pathway, the prefrontal cortex gets the most damage because the prefrontal cortex is the part of your brain that's supposed to put a limit on behaviors that put you in danger. And it's responsible for executive function, and it makes you generate willpower. And if you're trying to create healthy goals and stick to them, if your prefrontal cortex is damaged, then it's going to be really hard for you to keep your behavior functioning well. Basically, according to neuroscience, all of those pathways have been found to generate all human emotions. And so it continuously leads you back to this concept that behind every behavior is a reward. And if you don't understand why you execute certain behaviors, you're never going to get to the root of your self-sabotage, right? So self-sabotage, like we've been saying, is it's an addiction, but it's an addiction to self-harm. And like we've said, it's really hard for people to admit that or even comprehend it, right? And that's where I ask a really important question. How do you really know that what you believe about yourself and about the world is 100% true? You actually can't know that for sure, right? So what is the point in validating concepts that you've heard and holding on to them and forming conclusions on things? What is the actual point in that? And I think that's a really big question, and it's difficult for people to wrap their head around that because we have this built-in thing where we need to know that something is for sure, right? We have a fear of the unknown, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you are working with somebody who comes in to you and wants to modify or eliminate their self-sabotage behavior, with what you know in terms of how self-sabotage works from the standpoint of brain functioning and other things that are going on internally with us, what is your approach to, and how do you meld those two approaches between an individual's beliefs about themselves that lead to self-sabotage and what's going on within our brain and other internal structures that are contributing to that as well, too?
You know what is good about people and also bad is that everybody has this cognitive distortion, this filter that they run their thoughts through, and something must be wrong with me. So they're already judging themselves. So usually in the first session, what happens is that they'll start talking about themselves and they'll start talking about their family and their childhood and all these things that they think they're supposed to talk about. And they give you so much information that you can get a good sense of where you need to start looking. Mm-hmm. Like they tell on themselves all the time. But that's what we do though. As human beings, when you talk to anybody, you're really talking to their belief systems playing out. You're not actually talking to a personality. As soon as you mention a topic, the subconscious mind says, okay, go unpack that. And then you start having all these thoughts that go back to these programs. And that's what I like to call the cereal box hypothesis. And say you have a box of cereal, it's Captain Crunch, and the box itself is the subconscious program, or it's the conditioned behavior. When you pour that cereal into a bowl, all those individual pieces of cereal are an idea, a thought, another belief, a behavior, an emotion that's linked to that box of cereal. So until you get a person to empty all of that out and question those things, why do you do that? What's the reward for doing that? A person is never really going to see themselves the way that they are. They just see themselves as a constructed version that they've used to justify that, right? So you have to get people to talk through those things. And then once I get people to talk through those things, I know exactly what tools I have to do. But I do most of my work anyway. I can guarantee you that a client is going to have their eyes closed a lot of the time. Because when their eyes are open, and they have all this stimulus coming in, they're looking all around the room, they're looking for things to distract them from what's going on in their mind's eye. And then for a lot of people, the first time that they really pay attention or have a moment where they're not ignoring something is when their eyes are closed, because the subconscious is just asking one question: is it okay to keep this thing? And people don't know that you can actually just say yes or no to those things and have it resolve itself. What people are afraid of is that they actually internally know that, And a lot of things have a little sting to it emotionally, that when they start to look at stuff, they don't want to feel that sting, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So that's pretty much what I do a lot to try to begin to unravel what's happening. And then it depends on what the issue is, because I've had clients that I've mentioned this to you before, where I had a client, she wanted to stop smoking because she had to have a surgery. And we discovered that the reason why she was doing all the things that she was doing, especially sabotaging her relationships and smoking, was because she was watching Bridget Jones's Diary and she was living Bridget Jones's life. But what she did from the time that movie came out and she had the books and everything was that when she had a bad day, she would come right home and turn on her favorite movie and watch it. So she watched it so many times that stress fear memory pathway was activated and she onboarded Bridget Jones's personality, her behaviors and coping mechanisms without realizing it.
Wow. That's interesting. Another complimentary, I think, example I could give is I've talked to individuals who are addicted who said that a lot of times they would go to somebody else's house that they knew didn't have addiction in their household just to see what normal looked like. Or the other thing, they would grow up watching Father Knows Best or like one of those Ozzie and Harriet and think everybody's father was like Robert Young. And I would tell clients there's a difference between the idealized version and what the dysfunctional version is somewhere in the middle. No father is going to come home after a 12-hour workday with his hair, every hair perfectly in place, his tie in place, his suit in place, and be ready to talk about the day's problem. So I said, mm-hmm. It's important that we try to find a middle ground with that. But a lot of it is because of, again, the beliefs, the distorted beliefs that they've incorporated between what's real and what isn't. What you said about cognitive distortions, unless individuals are willing to put those beliefs out on the table, and you would take them through a process where, okay, show us evidence where this belief actually is valid. Show me evidence where this belief can be disputed. And we try to help them discover a middle ground with a belief that is more realistic and will allow them to not only discontinue self-sabotage behavior, but engage in proactive behavior. That's the work that I think is important to do, but it also takes a lot of time. Belief work is very arduous and very mm-hmm. time-consuming because those beliefs have been ingrained subconsciously, I think, and automatically, and they also contribute, I think, to self-sabotage behavior in addition to all the other the brain factors and other biological factors that you discussed that make it such a subconscious process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another thing about the media, too, is that people look for things that justify their everyday experiences as well. So they'll tend to gravitate towards content that already reinforces what's happening in their life currently. And this might sound ridiculous to a lot of people. I thought it was ridiculous the very first time it actually happened. But I had a client that was a fan of the TV show Friends. And they just thought that everybody's relationship with their friend circle was dysfunctional. And they did things because the character Ross Geller, because Ross Geller acted a certain way, they actually onboarded that behavior and they didn't realize that they were doing that as well in their friend circle. They thought that all that stuff was normal. There's people that don't understand, like I've mentioned this to you previously when we talked, that those comedies and stuff, like I said, everything that's funny, it probably has something in it that is infactual. There's probably lies about that in there, or lies about how you should behave, lies about how you should relate to alcohol or some other drug or something. Situational comedies, there's a reason why they're called that, sitcoms, mm-hmm. because they create a fictional situation, or that's often a very real situation that could happen. And they try to tell you how you should relate to it. And they use humor to embed that set of behaviors in you. And I know a lot of people that have picked up behaviors from, these are personal friends and stuff, not clients, that they picked up behaviors from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I'm trying to remember what's this other movie. It'll come back to me eventually. It was something, another thing with Johnny Depp. But what I realize is that there's a lot of actors out there that play particular archetypes And that we subconsciously have these archetypes embedded in us already. And so we look to these TV shows to figure out what behaviors we should emulate. And that's going to be an automatic process because of mirror neurons and things like that. But I don't want to keep harping on the TV and stuff like that. But this is what we do. We emulate behaviors from the environment. We don't know that they're bad for us. We just do it. We don't question it. And on the other side of a belief is a certain level of fear. And the best part about doing this work is when somebody gets rid of a whole bunch of maladaptive beliefs and they become a brand new person. And like you said, they're like, I can't even believe that I was afraid of this thing, or I didn't want to let go of this thing. Mm. I knew a lady that she had everything else going for her except for her relationships, but she kept self-sabotaging by going out and getting drunk. And it started to spiral out. And that's when she contacted me, and she's pretty old. She's in her 50s. And she was like, I just can't believe that I've spent like better part of 30 something years drinking to deal with my issues. And her problem was very simple. She had no idea what it actually felt like to not drink. She had no idea what it felt like to be safe in her body and to be okay with tough emotions and stuff like that. So she would just suppress. And when we figured out that she just had a belief that said, I don't understand what it feels like to live without drinking alcohol. And that was one of the main things that was running the show. Till we figured that out, she was pretty much frantic. She questioned everything that she did. It was like dealing with a hypochondriac almost, the way that she acted. And then very quickly, it was like dealing from one day to the next with a different person. And I think she travels the world doing like service work, volunteer work and stuff like that. Now she's very fulfilled. So it's incredible how these things that are small really hold us back.
Yeah, and sometimes it's the little things as opposed to the big things that either hold us back or get us to move forward. So one of my last questions for you today, Jahan, if you're going to leave our listeners with one thing today, what would that be?
It would be that you don't know what you don't know. And oftentimes you don't know how to do the things that you don't know how to do. That probably sounds very mystical and woo, but it's true. If you really think about it, a lot of the times the thing that blocks you is that you just don't know how to unpack something. You don't know how to approach something. And the way that you see yourself isn't really the reality. And as long as you keep that in mind, you can use that simple idea as a concept to continuously poke and prod at what the content of your mind actually is.
And that poking and prodding is going to be an ongoing process. I'll be poking and prodding at my mind in different ways and rediscovering new things about myself for as long as I'm alive. And probably when I go into the next dimension, that process of discovery will continue with a different set of teachers. My last question for you today, if people want to get in touch with you, contract for your services, what's the best way for them to do that?
So if you want to get in contact with me, let's see if I have a slide for that. Yeah, I do have a slide for that. Let's put that on the screen so it'll save you a lot of effort. You can get me on Instagram at Jahan Sator, or you can email me at selfsabotageinfo@proton.me.
You got it. That sounds great. And this will also be in the program notes. And for those of you who are going to be watching this on YouTube, you'll obviously will see the slides that Jahan shared. But anyway, thank you so much for being a valuable guest contributor today on the Teaching Journeys podcast. I truly enjoyed our conversation, and I look forward to being on your podcast very soon.
Yes.
And I look forward to that conversation. So again, Jahan, thank you very much for spending time with me and my listeners today.
Well, thanks again, Dave.
My pleasure. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.